The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week,
we're interested in learning what the interior of Jupiter looks like and what Jupiter consists of, in addition to the largely hydrogen and gases that we know of.
Yes, the shuttle may be no more, but NASA is still busy exploring the solar system. We hear from one of the team readying themselves for a mission to Jupiter. And
here we have a very simple and very efficient protein manufacturing system that simply uses sunlight, water, and soil.
Is the future of drug production more likely to be found in a field rather than a lab? I talked to Professor Julian Marr about his use of GM crops to produce antiviral drugs. And to help me catch up on the deluge of science news this week, I'll be joined by The Guardian's Ian Sample. We'll be discussing the ethics of ghostwriting scientific papers, vampire bats, and colonic irrigation. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. On the heels of NASA's final shuttle mission, the US Space Agency has not been sitting idle. Last week, if all went to plan, it launched a robotic mission to Jupiter. Juno will be the first dedicated mission for decades to the solar system's biggest planet. Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample spoke to one of the mission scientists, Jack Kinnerney, before the probe left the Earth. He started by asking Jack what the Juno probe was out to see.
Juno is going to deliver a suite of 8 science instruments plus a camera for education and public outreach to explore the Jovian system with a focus on Jupiter and its interior. We're interested in learning what the interior of Jupiter looks like, how the mass is distributed inside Jupiter, and what Jupiter consists of, in addition to the largely hydrogen and helium gases that we know of. We're interested in how much of the heavy elements, the rocky material that made up the terrestrial planets, how much of that is also incorporated in the interior of Jupiter. And this will help us understand how the solar system formed, how all the planets formed from the solar nebula some 4.5 billion years ago. The idea is that basically all the mass in the solar system, or the vast majority of it that's left over after the sun was formed, resides in Jupiter. And Jupiter is so massive that none of the stuff that was originally there got away or escaped from Jupiter. So it's a sample, essentially, of the primitive solar nebula that the planets were formed out of.
We've all seen a lot of pictures of Jupiter, just normal sort of optical kind of photographs. Is it harder to get information on the interior? I mean, this is a gas giant. Are there different techniques you have to use? And does studying the magnetic field give you a kind of unique way to try and understand what's going on in the interior?
Yeah, we really have two ways to probe the interior. The first is a gravity experiment, and the second is to study the magnetic field, as you say. In the case of gravity, what we're trying to figure out is what is the distribution of heavier elements. Are they evenly distributed throughout the planet, or are they condensed in a central rocky core? And this is one of the clues that will help us decide how planets formed. So for the gravity investigation, we use the telecommunication system on the satellite, the transmitter and receiver that sends commands to the spacecraft and receives data from the spacecraft. So as the spacecraft is orbiting Jupiter, it feels a little less or a little more gravitational acceleration relative to the average, and moves slightly differently along the line of sight. And by looking at the details of the radio signal we get back from the spacecraft, the science team can deduce whether the mass is evenly distributed or if it's more concentrated toward the center of the planet. And that's one of the clues that we'll use in conjunction with the information about the composition of the planet, the heavy elements that are sprinkled in there.
Is the magnetic field of Jupiter particularly strong, and does it give rise to particularly spectacular aurora?
Oh, yeah. It's the planet's magnetic field is huge. Now, Jupiter is the biggest planet in the solar system. It's also rapidly rotating. So it's probably no surprise that it has the strongest magnetic field of all the planets. It's an Earth-like field in the sense that it has the same kind of geometry that the Earth's field does, and Jupiter's north pole is displaced from the magnetic pole is displaced from the north pole by some 10 degrees or so, much like the Earth's. But it's about 20,000 times stronger than the Earth's magnetic field. And now, because Jupiter is a very large planet, the magnetic field magnitude on the surface of the planet is about 20 times the intensity of the field on the surface of the Earth. So actually, Juno will be flying through a magnetic field that's far more intense than any spacecraft has ever experienced. We'll fly through a field of up to 10, 12 Gauss. And because of that, we've actually had to look at the engineering of some of the subsystems on the spacecraft to make sure they operate the way they should in the presence of such a strong magnetic field.
How long will it take Juno to get out to Jupiter and position itself in orbit?
Well, it takes about 5 years. After launch here, we go out a little bit into the solar system beyond Earth, and we come back 2 years from now and swing by the Earth to get a bit of a gravitational assist. And then it's another 3 years out to Jupiter orbit insertion. I don't have the timeline right in front of me, but it takes about 5 years.
And once it's in orbit, it stays there going around Jupiter on this polar orbit for about a year. What happens at the end of the mission? What happens to Juno after that year?
Well, at the end of our nominal mission, which it's about 32 or 33 orbits, depending on how you count them, we're going to deactivate or send the spacecraft crashing into Jupiter. Now, there's a couple of reasons for doing that. You're very familiar, of course, with a lot of NASA missions that seem to go on and on and on, like the Energizer Bunny. But you know, we've had a particularly challenging time trying to get this spacecraft into close orbit around Jupiter because Jupiter has a very intense radiation environment. It's kind of like the Van Allen belts on Earth, only it's 1,000 times more intense. So we've designed this mission in order to protect the spacecraft systems and components. We've designed it to basically duck under the radiation belts as best we can. So for the first year in orbit, we're able to orbit the planet and sneak in under the radiation belts to limit the exposure to all of the instruments and the electronics. But after about a year, the orbit progresses to a state where we're just accumulating a great deal of radiation every time we swing by. Now, the other thing we've done on this mission is we've put all of the instruments inside of a 500-pound vault that's about a half-inch thick, meter-on-a-side cube of titanium, which is intended to block much of the penetrating radiation from the instruments. And even with all the tricks we can muster, after about a year, the accumulated dose gets to the point where we would soon experience some kind of a failure and lose control authority of the spacecraft. So the other reason for calling an end to this after the 30 orbits is that we want to be sure that we don't contaminate Europa because of the planetary protection requirements. So we dump the spacecraft basically into Jupiter in order to guarantee that, you know, sometime in the future, some hundreds of years from now, we wouldn't have a piece of debris up there that would impact Europa and contaminate the surface.
And will you be able to take any measurements as you go down into Jupiter?
I think we'll probably communicate with it until the last moment.
That was NASA scientist Jack Kinnerney there. For more information on the Juno mission, head to our website, guardian.co.uk/science. We've taken a break from science news these past few weeks, so today it's back with a bang. Joining me in the studio is Ian Sample, the Guardian science correspondent. Ian, let's kick off with the problem of ghostwriting in medical journals. Ian, do you want to just take us through what this is? What is a ghostwritten article and where is it used?
This is a problem that's been plaguing the medical community for quite a while. And essentially what happens is you have a pharmaceutical company that wants a research paper written about its product, and it usually wants that research paper to show its product in a good light. It will employ a medical writing agency to write the paper up. But crucially, often the names of the people who actually write the paper don't appear on the paper, but they get some academic who is influential in the area to lend their name to the paper, and that goes into a high-ranking journal. And so the fear is that these kinds of things tend to skew the literature. And also there's a simple sort of dishonesty going on, because often the author who lends their name to the paper hasn't been through all of the original data or really understand the study as well as they should do.
So who was it who actually was behind this call to arms?
Well, this was a couple of law professors at the University of Toronto. One of them holds a similar position in a medical faculty there. And they were just saying that a lot of professional societies and high-ranking medical journals have tried to bring in their own kind of measures to curb this practice. But these law professors were saying that those simply weren't having an effect. They weren't doing anything to change the rates of this, the how often this happens. And so they said, basically, what we need to do is recognize that academics who do this, and also the pharmaceutical companies and the medical writing agencies, themselves should be charged with professional misconduct. They should be reported to the various institutions that they come from, and also charged with fraud. They think this constitutes legal fraud.
Now, this came along, this particular paper, in the wake of a whole trove of documents that were released in 2009 after an information request by Pelos Medicine and the New York Times. Can you tell us a bit about that?
That's right. I mean, this is just one example, but it's a very good example. I mean, in this case, there was a medical company called Wyeth who was found to have employed a medical writing agency to write 26 different articles that went into all the journals. And those articles tended to emphasize the benefits of using a hormone therapy for conditions that therapy wasn't originally kind of licensed for, so things like heart disease and dementia. They also played down the kind of side effects and the problems that might come out from using the therapy in that way. Now, this kind of became a bit of a problem later on when government studies that actually looked at this had to be stopped early because trying to use hormone therapy for some of those conditions increased the rate of breast cancer and other conditions. And so it was essentially found that those articles were written in a very skewed way and had sort of slanted what people understood to be the truth about these medicines and their safety.
Now, these two lawyers, they've brought this up. Are they sort of whistling in the wind a bit, or have they got supporters?
Well, interestingly, what they do in the paper is they draw out how under certainly US law, there is probably a means by which this sort of fraud charges could be brought already, because there are certain laws in place that you might want to go for, that a class action might be successful in going after a company, going after that might be a pharmaceutical company or academics in themselves. Now, the journal editors I spoke to about this, they're all fantastically in favor of it, but you can't help wondering, well, how is this actually going to move on? How is this going to change anything? I mean, if you look at, there was a good review that looked at rates of this kind of, they call it guest authorship, when you put your name on a paper that you haven't necessarily written yourself. It was about 7-8% of authors said they'd done it in 2006. You do it again in 2009, the percentage has hardly changed. So none of the measures brought in so far have been effective. I don't actually see how these guys coming out and saying these people should be charged with fraud is going to change anything, because a lot of people who matter already are against it and nothing's been realistically changed.
All right, from very serious medicine to very important bat news. This is really important. So just this week in Nature, the details of how vampire bats detect blood from a distance were revealed. Now, you've probably wondered this, right? I mean, vampire bats, they go in and they stick their fangs into veins of a cow or a sheep or something, or whatever else is around, quickly, draw out a couple of tablespoons of blood, and then, you know, scuttle off again. Actually, they don't fly towards their prey. They actually scuttle on the ground, which is weird. But anyway, so you know, the thing is, they've got a very short window. How do they find the blood or the exact place to sort of pierce this animal? Well, it turns out that on their upper lips, on their noses, if you will, they've actually got a set of neurons, nerve cells rather, that are highly sensitized to detecting heat. And they're essentially infrared sensors. And you're smiling at this. Of course you are. But I know, Ian, you like a good curry, a hot curry. Well, it turns out that the same gene that controls the growth of these infrared sensors on the bat's lip, a version of that is on your tongue, helping you to taste and enjoy the pain of a hot curry. How does that make you feel?
Let's come back to this the vampire bat. I thought that the vampire bat would just basically latch onto, say, the ankle of a cow, and it would hasn't you know really got many places to go to look for the kind of blood vessel down that way. I thought it would just have a little trial and error.
Well, no, this is the point. It hasn't got much time before. You can't just sit there for 2 hours poking some sort of animal in various places. So it needs to know where to you know, thrust in its fangs, so to speak, and get away quickly, because otherwise it'll be just literally batted away. But so this molecule, actually, TRPV1, what it does, as I said, mentioned before, in humans and many other species, actually, it's a heat detecting thing. Whereas for us, it is the version that we have allows us to detect painful amounts of heat. So anything above 43 degrees, anything that's going to cause damage, and this thing switches on and it stops you from going towards that heat source. In bats, the version of TRPV1, actually it's set down slightly so that it detects anything above 30 degrees C. It starts tingling above 30. So it can tell the difference between warm veins and the rest of the flesh from about 20 centimeters away. And this is how, from a distance, it can tell where the blood's flowing, scuttle straight over, get its blood, off it goes. Because it needs to drink blood every single day. Ian, to finish off this section, there's a health warning. Actually, you're a 21st century man. You like cleansing. Have you ever thought about having a colonic irrigation?
Never.
You've never thought of it. Well, it turns out you're probably right not to. many people do these things. Or I think you have strong laxatives, or you might pump water the wrong way up your colon to flush out bad things. I'm looking over at producer Jason. He's familiar with this, it seems. Anyway, the point is that this is offered in spas and health clinics and all sorts, and people do these things and celebs love it. And there was a study published in the American Journal of Family Practice. It's more of a literature review than an actual interventional study. And what they looked at was lots and lots of case studies of people who had colonic irrigations or hydrotherapy or similar things, and to look at whether actually it does anything. What do you think they found?
I suspect that it's not beneficial.
No, it's not only not beneficial. The headline from the press release, which was quite funny, was something like colonic irrigation or colonic hydrotherapy, no benefits, potential side effects include vomiting and death. So it's pretty categorical, really. But what the doctor at Georgetown University School of Medicine was saying was that, first of all, we have our own very natural processes to get rid of the stuff in there. It doesn't need help. And you might think, well, it's just benign, surely. Just put a bit of water up there, it comes out again. Well, she says, well, no, not really, because you put so much water up there. She said, it's quite dangerous. You're inserting tubes and using up to 60 litres of fluid.
60.
Which can cause punctures in the colon.
I mean,
doctors do enemas and that kind of thing for particular medical reasons, but they use very small amounts of water. And if you're sticking things anywhere near there, then possibly you can tear things and infections will arise. And that's what she's trying to work out, is that it's not worth all of that, at the risk of all of that, for literally no benefit? And it's not even a psychological benefit, because I'm sure it's not very pleasant either. She basically don't do it. This is Dr. Ranit Mishori at the university. She was saying that the body's designed to get rid of toxins in urine and feces. There really is no need to assist.
Well, it's an interesting psychology here, because of all the things there are to do in life, it's hard to see how having 60 litres of water pushed into your rectum would reach high up on the list of things to do on any given day.
Yes. Thanks to Ian Sample there. For more news, go to guardian.co.uk/science.
And now, the Hanford question.
My name's Mark Linus. I'm author of The God Species. And the question I would like answered is, does Gaia really exist? So is the Earth a self-regulating superorganism, or does biology and physics have nothing to do with it, that we're just lucky to be here at the right temperature?
Regular listeners will know that the techno-environmentalist Mark Linus has been causing not an insignificant amount of controversy with his support for GM crops. One of the ripostes to this position is often the question, what can GM crops do that normal crops can't? Well, Professor Julian Maher, a molecular immunologist, can answer that question. His research focuses on the use of genetically modified tobacco plants to produce antibodies against HIV. His team at St George's Hospital Medical School in London has just received the green light in Europe to carry out a clinical trial of the antibody produced by his crops. At the moment, most drugs are created using genetically modified mammal or bacterial cells. When I spoke to Professor Maher, I asked him to outline how GM plants might be better.
Well, there's a couple of steps here, really. I mean, I think the first thing you could do is you could just use plant cells, and you could grow them up in big fermenters as well. And in fact, that has been done, and the first recombinant medicine from a plant is going to be made like that, from fermentation broths of carrot cells, for example. The reason we have moved away from that is because in those fermentation sort of systems, you're always constrained by the scalability of the system. So if you wanted to make huge volumes of medicines, it becomes very, very expensive. And that's really down to the fact that these fermentation vats have to be kept absolutely sterile, and the manufacturing facilities that are involved are very, very expensive themselves. So the thinking really behind going to whole plants was that here we have a very simple and very efficient protein manufacturing system that simply uses sunlight, water, and soil to make proteins. And I mean, I think it's no coincidence that plants are at the bottom of the food chain, because it's the cheapest and most economical way of making proteins at large scale. So it makes good sense, if you're thinking about genetically modifying an organism, to start thinking about you using plants in the first place.
When you, in the experiments you've done, how pure is the drug that comes, the protein that comes out?
Right.
And how much processing does it need?
So I think that was one of the original very big questions, was whether you could make proteins to the same quality and the same standard as the proteins that you could make in these fermentation systems. And there are sort of very many potential variables here, because, of course, we're not dealing with a vat full of identical cells. We're dealing with a greenhouse full of non-identical plants, for example. And the conditions under which you grow those plants inherently has some variability. So, for example, you know, this daylight affects it. There's variability of the environment around the greenhouse. And potentially, there's the fact that you've got soil in your greenhouse, and that's the medium for growing your plants. Compare that with the very strictly regimented growth conditions for fermentation systems, where you have a very tightly identified medium to grow your cells in. You keep them at a certain temperature, and the environmental conditions are constant throughout, you could see that there are inherently many variations, much scope for variability in a plant system. So our study really was all about whether the plant-derived recombinant antibodies could be made at the same quality. And what we've shown in our work is exactly that, that despite all the variation in the inputs, what comes out of the plant can be made to very high quality. And in fact, the quality that we reached was even higher than had been previously achieved using the Chinese hamster ovary cell system.
Now, you've just been given permission by the UK regulator to carry out a clinical stage of your research in growing anti-HIV drugs. Now, can you just take us through that?
So the reason for proposing to go through to a clinical trial was that we knew that all new pharmaceuticals have to go through the same regulatory process. So the Medicines and Health-Related Products Agency, the MHRA, are the governing body in the UK that oversees the production of pharmaceuticals and ensures that the quality is suitable. And we chose a monoclonal antibody because we knew that the gold standard for manufacturing monoclonal antibodies was very well established in CHO cells, and that was what we were going to be up against. So after 7 years of work, we have established a manufacturing platform using plants, which an external regulator has looked at and decided reaches the same quality as that which we would expect from the gold standard, the current gold standard. So for us, a major hurdle was gaining that regulatory approval. Now, we have chosen to examine an anti-HIV antibody partly because that same antibody made in CHO cells has already been through the regulatory system, and so a quality specification had already been established for that antibody, and so we knew what we would have to, the minimum requirement we would have to meet. We also knew, of course, that it was safe because it's gone through the clinical trials, and the only difference between what had previously gone through clinical trial and what we are putting into clinical trial is the fact that the antibody is now made in plants. So at the end of the clinical trial, if we can show that the plant-derived antibody is inherently safe despite its manufacture in plants, then I think that opens up the floodgates, really, for the manufacturer of many new monoclonal antibodies for different diseases using plants.
So you've used tobacco plants in this particular platform.
Yeah.
Could you use any plant at all, or are there particular plants that are particularly good?
Well, actually, in fact, the research field has looked at many different plant species, and every laboratory, I think, has their favorite. So there are very few plant species that cannot be genetically modified, and there are some plant species which have some specific advantages. So part of our project was actually to do an analysis of the plant species available and to do carry out essentially a review of what would be the best plant species to work in. And I think there are some other species, such as maize, for example, which would work very well because any plant that produces a seed would be a good target for us because seeds are essentially dehydrated protein storage bodies, and that would be a very valuable requirement, a very valuable end product for us trying to make recombinant proteins. The reason why we've chosen tobacco is for several reasons. Probably the most important one is that it's not part of the food chain, and we were acutely aware that we needed to find a species that would not give us environmental issues about whether we might pass our product into the food chain. Secondly, of course, tobacco is a major crop around the world. So if you're looking at non-food crops, tobacco is probably the best established one. Thirdly, it produces a huge amount of biomass. So you know, if you want to create a very large scale production system, biomass levels are important. And fourthly, genetic modification of tobacco is actually very easy and straightforward, and it's been worked out for many years.
I was going to ask that question, actually. How easy is it to program these, in your case, the tobacco plant, to make very complex molecules? I mean, you've done the antibody for HIV, but if you wanted to take this beyond HIV and other diseases, I mean, how you'd need quite complex pharmaceuticals. I mean, is that possible?
Well, I think this is one of the huge advantages of using plants. In 1989, when the first publication emerged that plants could produce antibodies, there was some sort of amazement in the scientific community, if you like. But quite quickly, it was realized that there was no reason why plants shouldn't be able to make complex molecules like monoclonal antibodies. And in fact, you know, we went on to show that they could make much more complex proteins. And in that respect, they are vastly superior to E. coli or yeast in many ways. And there are some complex proteins that you can make in plants that you can't make in any other system. So I think plants, one of the great areas for sort of potential growth of plants is in making not just very complex molecules, but also, let's say, combinations of complex molecules like antibodies. So to give you an example, the product that we're working on, the anti-HIV antibody, eventually will have to be used in combination with one or maybe two other antibodies. It's very unlikely this antibody will be used by itself. And the reason for that is that HIV is very good at mutating, and so you need to provide two or three different antibodies to avoid what's called viral escape. So that concept of a combination of molecules is applicable across the board for infectious diseases. I think plants give you the option of making many molecules to add to a cocktail of a pharmaceutical, because the price, so the potential cost of making the molecules is much lower than conventional systems. So you can afford to make cocktails of two or three antibodies, whereas we, up until now, we haven't been able to afford that.
Now, what kind of diseases do you think you're going to try and tackle first when it comes to this technology? Is it going to be infectious diseases, or can you even go up to things like statins and antidepressants and that kind of thing?
I think infectious diseases are a very attractive target for several reasons. First of all, monoclonal antibodies, which are made particularly well in plants, have been used against many infectious diseases, and we know they work really well. And so, I mean, obviously we've started in HIV, but we also have projects looking at rabies and tuberculosis and a number of other diseases. And the second reason for it is that I think our technology really has benefits in the developing world, where most of the infectious diseases are. So what, you know, what are the unique selling points of our technology? Well, it's the low cost of production and it's the large scalability. And where you will see those advantages come to the fore is when you try to provide medicines for poor people in underdeveloped countries. And that happens to coincide then with the prevalence of infectious diseases, which is predominantly in developing countries. With regards to other targets, well, the same kind of molecules, monoclonal antibodies, have been used to great effect against cancers of certain types, and I mentioned Herceptin earlier on. And so I think cancers might be another good target. For some of the other conditions that you mentioned, well, we have to look at protein targets. This technology is all about making proteins rather than sort of small chemical entities. So I think we would have to select those carefully.
Will your technique make it cheaper to make these vaccines and distribute them?
Well, that's a very good question. We have always argued that the production of these medicines will be cheaper using plants. And I think in reality that will be the case. But it turns out the real cost of pharmaceuticals is not down to the cost of the goods themselves. It's much more related to the many years it takes to develop a drug and, well, many other steps. And often the final cost of a drug is more determined by things like the intellectual property that's had to be protected, even the packaging, actually. So in the sort of the drugs that you and I get from the pharmacist, the cost of goods apparently does not make much difference to the cost that we actually pay. Where I think the cost benefit does come in, though, is in the very early stages of drug development. So in a plant system, the investment you have to make early on to test a new drug is much lower than if you wanted to make it by conventional systems. And that could be 10 to 100-fold cheaper. Now, we know that many drugs fail in the first few years of development for many, many reasons. But if the cost of trialing each of those drugs is very high, I think very few people are able to sort of enter the field, as it were. If you make the cost of entry, as it were, into looking at new drugs much lower by using plant technologies, I think that is a win. It's a win-win for everybody, actually. But what it also allows you to do is bring underdeveloped countries in to look at drugs which they might find very important. And we're very interested in this concept of developing production systems in the region for the region, in other words, for specific diseases. So to give you an example, you know, we have a project on rabies, which is a terrible disease, particularly in Southeast Asia and Africa, but really not of any great significance in the West, particularly in the UK. So, you know, I don't think there'll be much interest in developing those kind of products in the UK, but there would be great interest in developing it in places like India or China.
Thanks to Professor Julian Maher there, and of course we'll keep you up to date with the results of that clinical trial as it becomes public. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. At the moment, we're also doing some of our own research. We're really keen to get feedback on what you think about this and all our other audio and podcasts. If you'd like to be involved in a survey, just send us your name and contact details to scienceweeklypodcast@gmail.com. We'd really appreciate the help. For now, from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.